Welcome to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns. Real people, real voices, real lives, discussing mental health, addiction, and disability in the community. Your weekly window to the real world. Welcome to Take It From Us.
Welcome into our program. How are you doing? Make sure you tell us. And we've got the brand new website, of course, as well, tifuradio.org. And if you've missed any of our content, please jump on the website and have a listen back and let us know what you think. Plus, you can also tell us about people you think we need to get on our program. So please do that, tifuradio.org. I had my brother back for a few days last week, which was great. And, of course, the time goes way too fast. You count down the days to when close family members or friends turn up at your house, don't you? And then before you know it, they're gone. That's pretty much what happened last week. So I had my brother for about 4 or 5 days, and we had quite a lot to do. There were a few things that we both had to do together just in relation to a family matter, but we also got to spend some good time together, just the two of us, and just to chat, and it was really good. And I think he made a point about mateship and how, as we've gotten older, I guess the priorities for him have changed a little bit. And it was based on conversations he'd had with some of his buddies on Wednesday or Thursday night last week. And he came away feeling slightly unfulfilled with catching up with these guys. And I asked him why. And he said, there was lots of banter and there were lots of jokes and it was lots of fun, but I think I just wanted to talk to them. And actually what he said resonated with me, because I've got a great group of mates and the banter over the years has been pretty full on, you know, as Kiwi men do. We hang a lot of stuff on each other. We take the piss. We're very good at doing that. We're very good at making light of a situation. We're very good at papering over the cracks. We're not very good at opening up and just talking about how we're actually feeling. And look, I've got mates who still to this day, and I'm 45 years of age, and I've known these guys for 30 or 40 years, where if they make a comment, I'm still guessing, is he serious? Or is he joking? And I still don't know. And I can sometimes get frustrated by that. And I think it's because of what I need. I now need, I think, to be heard. I now need my friends to know how I'm doing. And the laughs are important. They so are important because they can make you feel good, as long as you're also talking about the important things in life. That's what I've come to believe now. You know, when I catch up with my buddies, we always now make sure we talk about how we're doing. And we haven't come to an agreement. We haven't made that official. It's just the way that it goes. And I think it's because life has never seemed more challenging than it is now. Guys in our mid-40s with mortgages or high rental to pay, families, work stress, all of these things, not to mention all of the trauma that we've been through in recent times. And so the laughs are important, but I think we also need to just chat. And I want to know how they're doing. I genuinely want to know how they are doing. And I need them to know how I'm doing. And I think that's kind of where we've arrived at now. And mateship is good. It's really good. But friendship is better. It was just a good little chat that I had with my brother, and it got me thinking. I just wanted to share that with you very quickly. Our first guest on the program today was made redundant from her job. She started online gambling. She then started to get loans to pay for her debts, taking money from her employer, and then she was found out. She attempted to take her own life at this point. She's been to prison for fraud. She came out a year ago and is still on probation, but has got clean with the help of the Problem Gambling Foundation. We won't use her last name today on Take It From Us, but this is her story. Amanda, welcome to Take It From Us. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm really good. And it's nice to have you on the program because you do have a story to share with us about your life. How are things at for you right now?
Things are pretty good. Things after everything I've been through, I could say that I've come through it and I am doing well.
And you seem hopeful for the future.
Very much so, yeah. If you don't have hope, you've got nothing. And I have got lots of hope for my future.
That's so good to hear. What have you learned about yourself in the last little while?
That I'm actually much stronger than what I thought I am, and that resilience is a great thing.
Mm. How have you leant into that and learnt about it as you've gone on?
Well, I've actually grown up in a domestic violence household, and my father was an alcoholic, so I didn't have a great upbringing. And all of that accounted to my, childhood was turbulent. And learning to escape those challenges, I started to gamble. And it was my escape from all my dramas and troubles.
And tell us about the gambling.
Gambling consumed most of my life. I started off very innocently playing a $10 here and a $10 there, but I was pretty miserable in a job that I had, and I eventually got forced redundancy, and I was pretty unhappy at home, pretty bored with myself, and these ads just came up more and more and more on my iPad, and I started to play more and more, a $10 here, $20 there. And as soon as I had money in my account, I would play. And, of course, I would win a little bit of money here and there, and that just spurred me on to play more. So eventually I would play more than what I would win, and I would just wait for the next time that I had money in my account. So it just became a roller coaster of, when I had money, I would just play, and as I say, I would win sometimes, but I was always chasing the win.
And it's hard to end up on top in the long run, isn't it?
Yeah, you definitely don't ever win money back. You
put the game's rigged.
You put more in than what you win.
Mm. At what point did you think it became a problem for you?
I think very early on it became a problem because I was addicted to it very early on. I was always on my iPad, playing it. And as soon as I had money in my account, that was the first thing I was thinking about, is getting onto the gambling website and playing and chasing a win.
Do you think you were addicted very early?
I think I became addicted quite early on in my life, yeah.
Mm. And what you talked about the roller coaster. Describe for us the difference in emotions between winning and losing when you were gambling.
Of course, when I was winning, I was on a high. It was great. And then as soon as I was out of money and I was losing, I became quite depressed about it, and I was quite negative and angry. My mood would change severely from super high to super low, and I was also suffering from depression, so that was not helping me. My depression would really be bad when I was losing, and I was very irritable towards my family as well, kind of blaming everyone around me for losing the money.
Right, and what was your family's response to what was happening?
My family didn't really know that I was gambling. They thought I was playing games, but they didn't know that it was involving money. So I would just say to them, they would make remarks and say, get off your iPad and spend some time with us. But I would say, shh, leave me alone, I'm winning, But they didn't understand that I was actually gambling with money. They thought I was playing free games. So they had no idea what I was up to.
Did you have anyone that you could confide in to help support you?
No. While I was doing what I was doing, I had no one else knowing what was going on. I was living a secret life, and I was deceiving my family the whole time.
And what was the impact on you during this period?
I wasn't feeling great about the fact that I was, you know, living a double life. It wasn't great, you know, betraying my family this much. And then I was also taking out cash loans to try and find money to feed this gambling addiction. So financially I was basically ruining my life as well. So my husband never worked with the accounts. He never even, you know, withdrew money. He just trusted me with the money. So he had no idea what was going on in our finances. So eventually I couldn't service these loans that I took out. And one day a client came and paid cash, and I just decided to take that money from work. And that's how I started stealing from work, always with the intention of I'm going to put the money back. But it never came. And then one thing led to another, and I started taking more and more money from work. So eventually I ended up taking money from work for over 5 years before I got found out. And most of that money went to gambling. Mm. I've got nothing to show for that money, you know. I've just spent it all.
Mm. And then eventually that led you into some pretty serious trouble?
Yes. The day that I got found out at work, late the afternoon, they all came and got me out of the office, and I got paraded down, and all my bank accounts were frozen, even the ones I shared with my husband. So I went home and I just got a fresh 3-month prescription. And I was also addicted on painkillers, lots and lots of painkillers and prescription medication. So I've just got my new 3-monthly script. So I went home and collected all of those, went and booked into a seedy motel. And I rang my husband from the motel and I told him, I said, look, all our bank accounts are frozen. And I've stolen money from work. It's very serious. And I lied to him and I said to him, I'm going to hand myself in at the police station. So I then tried to commit suicide. My husband eventually that night told my kids what went on, and they were searching for me the whole night. So I've actually put my family through a hell of an ordeal. And the police were searching for me as well. So the cleaners of the motel found me the next afternoon in a critical state, and I eventually ended up in ICU. And about 5 days later, when I came by, all I remember is my kids saying to me, Mum, we know what you've done, but we still love you. So I had to face up, you know, facing my kids with what I've done and my husband, and having to go through the court system, knowing, you know, that I have to face up to that as well. It was the hardest thing that I've ever done, is to come clean and say, look, I'm addicted to gambling.
What was the level, and look, it's hard to imagine what you've been through, and I just wanted to say how grateful we are for you to being brave and honest with us on this program to share your story, because it is going to benefit others. But what was the level of understanding for your condition at the time, that you were not trying to get away with anything or to have personal gain, but you were actually trying to help yourself out of a situation that you found yourself in? How much understanding did you have?
I took it that I'm to blame for what I've done. I was wrong. I didn't see myself as being addicted. I just thought I'm a bad person. But with the Problem Gambling Foundation and the help that I got from them, I got to learn that it wasn't just me being a bad person. It's an addiction. And that helped me understood it better. And that helped me with self-forgiveness. Because I just thought I'm the worst person under the sun, you know. I'm a criminal, I'm a thief. I deserve everything that, you know, I got coming. But I now have got self-acceptance. You know, I made a very big mistake, and I've paid for this mistake. You know, I've gone to jail. I got a 3-year jail sentence. I've done a year jail, and I've got 2-year probation. I currently am still on probation. So That's how I've dealt with it.
Have you found forgiveness from your employer?
I don't think so, no.
Okay. Is there a level of understanding as to why you were doing what you were doing?
No. I don't think it's amicable on their part, no.
Did you feel hurt when you were going through the legal system? Did you feel that you were heard and that there was a context around your behaviour and people understood that?
My barrister tried and he sent me to an addiction specialist and they did lots of reports on me and that was all delivered to the courts. So the judge had a clear understanding of my addiction and that was all delivered into the court reports and they all had access to it. So what they did with that is it was given to the defence as well and to the Crown lawyers. So they all had insight into my addiction. So I don't know whether that was of any use to them, I must say.
Okay.
Whether that made it any easier, I can't tell you.
Tell us about the support you've received from the Problem Gambling Foundation.
Yep, I've walked a very long line with them. So just straight out of my hospital with my suicide attempt, I contacted them. And I've had over 4 years of counselling with Problem Gambling Foundation. They've been great. I've actually moved away from the city that I was living in and I couldn't continue on with their services. So they've actually switched it to phone counselling for me, which was absolutely tremendous. I've also happened to have a struggle to get mental health because I was still suicidal after I've been discharged from the hospital. So I spoke to my GP and I told him, you know, I'm having struggles, I'm suicidal. And they didn't kind of take me serious on it. So they kind of minimized the fact that, you know, gambling harm can make you suicidal. So My counsellor came with me from PGF services and she went with me to the doctor and it's only then that they took me serious and I got the mental health help that I needed.
And what's your view on gambling now?
I'll always be an addict. So I'll always have to stay away from machines and I'll always have to stay away from online gambling.
How confronting is that?
Very confronting. So I'll always class myself as an addict. And my message to other people will be, you know, don't do it if you haven't done it. Don't do it because it's addictive. It's designed to be addictive. And if you are doing it, get out as soon as possible.
Yeah, which is easier said than done, isn't it?
It is, but there is help, you know. There is help. Like, I've really gotten great help from Problem Gambling Foundation.
Did you know they were there? Did you think to reach out to them earlier?
I didn't know they were there, but I did research and I got... You know, found them on the website. So, and they were really amazing.
Yeah, and what sort of, can you tell us about the sort of support that you get as far as an understanding and an empathy and just having people there for you?
They're just very well versed. The counsellors are very well trained. And as I say, they do face-to-face counselling. They do email counselling. They do Zoom counselling. So any counselling that you can think of, they offer.
And what are your family? Is your family proud of what you've done and the path you've walked?
Yep, they definitely are. I'm studying as well, so as well as working again. So life is pretty good for me right now.
Great. What are you studying, if you can tell us?
I'm doing a health course in mental health and addictions. So I'm hoping to give back.
Wow. Yeah, and when you think of the path that you've come and you think about where you're at now and you think about your future, what comes to mind?
Hopefully I can walk this line and give back to the community. For everything good that I've received, I can hopefully give back and help someone else that's, you know, in where I maybe was. Yeah. You know,
and we know, Amanda, don't we? There are so many people that need to be helped.
Yeah. I could walk the line with them.
You walk the line with them you've had people walk the line with you. So now it's your turn to pass the baton on.
My turn to give back, yeah.
All right. Well, look, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. And we wish you all the very best with your study.
Thank you.
And stay strong.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Amanda. Appreciate it.
I woke up pissed off today. Lately, everyone feels fake. Somewhere I lost a piece of me. Smoking cigarettes on balconies. But I can't do this alone. Sometimes I just need a light. I call you on the phone. Need you on the other side. So when your tears roll down your pillow like a river, I'll be there for you. I'll be there for you. When you're screaming, but they only hear you whisper, I'll be loud for you. But you gotta be there for me too. Too. Last year took a toll on me, but I made it with you next to me. Around the world and back again. I hope you're waiting at the end, but I can't do this alone. Sometimes I just need a light. If I call you on the phone. On the other side, so when your tears roll down your pillow like a river, I'll be there for you. I'll be there for you. When you're screaming, but they only hear you whisper, I'll be loud for you. I'll be loud for you. I got you, I promise. But you gotta be there for me too. But you gotta be there for me too. Boy, I'm holding on to something. Wanna go with you for nothing. I'm running, running, just to keep my hands on you. There was a time that I was so blue. What I got to do to show you? I'm running, running, just to keep my hands on you. Running, running, just to keep my hands on you. Running, running, just to keep my hands on you. Instead of running, running, just to keep my hands on you. But you gotta be there for me too.
Take it from us, There For You. That's the name of that song from Martin Garrix. Right now on the program, we're talking about the work of Big Buddy, making a positive difference to boys without a dad. What are the benefits to young boys from buddying up? And what do we know about the impact these relationships also have on the men who become Big Buddies? Paul Burns is the chief executive of Big Buddy, and he joins us right now on Take It From Us. Thanks for your time, Paul. How are you?
I'm good, really good, Kent. Thanks for having me.
How is the Big Buddies program going?
It's going really well. We're 26 years old this year, and we exist to make a positive difference for 7 to 14-year-old boys who don't have their dads in their lives. And it's incredibly rewarding work. The need in New Zealand is significant. There's about approximately 8,000 boys in that age and have their dads in their lives. You know, so there's a gap. The mums, the brave, courageous mums that bring their boys to us, they talk, some of them talk about noticing or seeing this gap. You know, the boys, a boy without his dad is not broken, but there is a gap. Someone not around to sort of model or live what a good man looks like. And that's really simple stuff. That's simple things like, you know, role modelling selflessness. And the big buddy's doing that by showing up for the boy every week and hanging out, spending time.
Hmm. Yeah, and I know it's around 8,000, I think, in Auckland, but nationwide, I was looking at some numbers. For 7 to 14-year-old boys, close to 50,000 are living in solo parent families. And we to assume that the majority of cases they're living with mum. So it might be very difficult for them to have that male, strong male bond that you talk of.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Some are lucky enough to have a caring, loving uncle or grandparent or friend, you know, close by. It can be someone reasonably close in age, but yeah, a lot of them, and the mums that approach come to Big Buddy are ones that where there's pretty much nothing at all, and so in a way, those boys are the ones with the greatest need, really. If there's no positive sort of male role model at all in their lives, they're the ones we want to reach the most. Yeah, so. That's what we're up to. And, yeah, 26 years in, we're still learning every day, but we're proud of the difference we're making. We get incredible feedback from mums and caregivers talking about things like how their boy is growing in terms of resilience and self-confidence and self-esteem. But I have to say, nearly 6 years in my role as the proud chief executive, the most amazing thing I've heard from the mum of a Wellington little buddy actually was she thought a big buddy for her boy meant he would learn how to fix the car and do sort of blokey stuff. And, and of course some of that happens. And gosh, I my dad died when I was 15. I wish he'd taught me how to fix the car. I'm useless when it comes to fixing the car. But she went on to say, it's much bigger and it's much more important than that. My boy is learning how to talk and listen. He's learning how to show up and be there for his mates, and he respects me more. So, you know, we don't need too much more motivation than that. And if we can help our young boys grow into young men who are doing those things, you know, we're not only making a difference for that one boy, we're making a profound impact on the whole of society, the whole of our country, you know, because in terms of general well-being and being there for someone else and being respectful and using your manners, I think, you know, that stuff really makes the world go round. So we're really privileged and proud to be helping to shape that a little bit.
And I'll take a stab here and think that the big buddies get just as much out of it and learn just as much and get just as much pride and just as much joy as the little guys.
I'm glad you've said that, and you've hit the nail on the head. I remember a big buddy saying to one of the team, thank you so much. I hadn't climbed a tree for 40 years. You know, I think all of us have got that inner child, eh? That it's healthy to let that inner child out from time to time. And as adults, you get busy with work, life gets busy, and we forget to be playful or be a child, you know. So that's what these men, we get some amazing feedback like that. For obvious reasons, the motivation, the men are entering this mentoring, this friendship, this relationship, intending to give everything they possibly can to the boy, and it's about making a difference for the boy who doesn't have his dad. But a majority of the men, clear majority, most of them say to us, this is changing my life. I didn't realise how much I would get from this. And the cool thing is, some of them are passing on feedback from partners as well, saying that the partner has seen them I don't know, growing it maybe in their own resilience and emotional intelligence and confidence. So yeah, it's pretty. We like to talk about the ripple effect of the work we do. Our vision is actually to, the Big Buddy vision is to create a ripple of connection and hope through our young people across all of New Zealand. So that talks primarily to the fact that make a difference for one boy, and you know, over his lifetime he might come into contact with thousands of people, and the difference that the Big Buddy makes for that boy ripples out across all of those other people he interacts with. So that feels good too.
Have the Big Buddies been little buddies at some point? And what's kind of like the typical story for a Big Buddy? Do they come from, you know, troubled backgrounds, or were they lonely as young men, or are some of them dads themselves and they just want to give more back? Like, is there a kind of a typical, stereotypical Big Buddy?
That's such a good question. The answer is no, there's not. What we find is the men identify the need. So they hear about these boys who don't have their dads in their lives, and whether they had a stable, normal, if there's such a thing, loving childhood themselves, whether they have their own kids or not, back to that point around how beautifully simple it is in terms of what we're doing, that they can feel it, they can understand, they can connect with it, regardless of what their own personal circumstances are. And that's almost an advantage for us in a way, because lots of our Big Buddies didn't necessarily not have their father in their lives, but maybe, and this is part of my story, I had my dad for, you know, till I was 15, the most impressionable years for a boy. So I almost have a sense of gratitude that I had him that long. And so that was part of my motivation to join this organisation and give back in the way I give back. So these men are connecting with and identifying the need. You know, we've got the most sort of heartwarming growth we've had in the volunteers, the Big Buddies, is in this sort of 20 and 30 year age group, where it's such a cool reflection on society, I suppose, or New Zealand men who have a growing or an increasing sort of social conscience and want to, you know, a lot of them without their own children, but again, connect with the need, see the need and want to actually do something about it. And these incredible guys are stepping up for these boys and showing up every single week for them and just going out and climbing trees and doing simple stuff, and then the magic happens from there.
I'm sure somewhere someone is teaching a young guy how to fix a car. How long do some of these relationships last for?
We ask for a minimum. So all of our history and lots of global research shows that a boy in this situation without a positive male role model needs a minimum of 12 months and ideally weekly contact, or at least 3 weeks out of four per month for a year. And if the match or the friendship sort of slowed down or diluted after a year, that all the research in our history shows that boy's life has been impacted forever. However, because we put so much thought and care into getting the match right, and that means obviously personality types and shared interests and geography and things, and then the relationship grows really quickly often and quite naturally and organically, when it gets to the 12-month mark, unless the boy or the big or little buddy moves away from each other in terms of geography, but the Big Buddies say they could never think of stopping or slowing down. That they're getting so much out of it. They, over 50% of our matches last for 5 years or more. So that tells us we're doing something right. And it's really nice to hear those stories, the long-term matches.
Well, you know what makes me feel nice about these stories and what you're telling us is that we're living in a time now where we've never been more socially isolated. People all around the world are saying they've got fewer friends than ever who they can confide in. And yet what you guys are doing is organically creating environments where it's all about the connection and it's all about a quality connection. And look at what is the payoff seems to be just really, really great.
That's really well said. You know, a question I often get asked is, and a lot of men, I think, wonder this when they're considering stepping up, is they ask, what do they do? What do we do? What are we supposed to do? Do we need to spend money? Do we need to sort of entertain them? And they don't. What they need to do, one of the big buddies themselves actually said this to us when we did some work on our brand and did some surveys. He said, we asked him to describe what it is they do, and he said, we show up, we spend time, and we come back. Now, and that's actually all they need to do. They might climb a tree, they might go to a cafe, they might go and kick a ball, they might sit under a tree and say nothing. And there is something magical still happening when that, regardless of what they're doing. It's like you said, it's about connection and showing up. And we like the phrase, you know, authentic, caring connection. And it doesn't matter what that is. It could be walking along the beach. It could be throwing stones into the creek. It could be, it's all of those things and more. It could be the big buddy helping the little buddy with his homework.
It's basically what you want. You're wanting the big buddy to show up and just be himself.
Well, correct.
Yeah.
And that's an advantage for us, because when we talk, that's our sort of, that's an example of our message to the world. When we talk like that, everyone gets it. Man, woman, child can understand that and have some level of connection with that, because that's what we all should be doing with each other all the time, is just showing up and being ourselves. So the relationships, the matches start, get strengthened very quickly, because that's not hard to do. You don't need qualifications, or you just need to show up and be yourself. And the boy will get so much from that.
How do we get involved?
Thank you for asking that. The best thing to do is to go to bigbuddy.org.nz. Our website's got heaps and heaps of incredible information, stories about matches, more information in terms of what's involved in the process. That's the very, very, very best place to go.
Are you well supported?
Yes, we are. We've got some incredible, incredible supporters. It's a daily focus is income, and we work hard to generate nearly all of it. We get a very small percentage from the government, which we are grateful for, but everything else we have to generate ourselves. So, yeah, we're grateful for the support we've got, but it's an ongoing challenge, and it's going to be probably a relatively tough sort of 18 months, 2 years ahead. Off the back of cost of living for people and lowish, you know, business confidence, the tragic weather events around the country. So tough times, but again, we are proud of what we're achieving, and we think our story is compelling. So as long as we tell it the right way and can reach people, and thank you, you're helping us with that, people will connect. And yeah, so we work hard at it. We work hard at generating the support.
Yeah, and look, you're a fence at the top as opposed to an ambulance at the bottom, because I can imagine for a lot of these young guys who might be troubled, if you can provide them with someone who cares about them as an individual and as a person at the age of 7, 8, or 9, that can be life-changing and actually help to steer them down a path of one of fulfillment as they get older.
Again, we love hearing from mums who say things like, oh, one or two have gone as far as saying they don't think their boy would even be here if it wasn't for his big buddy, and others who say, you know, he was sort of close to, he was starting to make some bad choices and bad decisions, and, you know, in terms of the type of people he might be hanging around with, some are you know, getting into mischief, getting into trouble, not attending school, things like that. And so, again, you're right. Matching a boy without his dad around with a big buddy means we are as getting in as young as possible, I suppose, and trying to be preventative. We definitely deliberately like to be in that position.
Have you been a big buddy yourself, Paul?
No, I haven't, Kent. I get asked about that a lot, and some people, when I tell them I'm at Big Buddy, they default, they assume I'm a volunteer Big Buddy. And actually, this is happening, it's worth mentioning too, this is happening lots in New Zealand. So a type of Big Buddy, in a way, are sports coaches. You know, there's lots of people who are showing up for young people or younger people than them every day, all the time. So I've volunteered in my local football club on the board and as a coach, and love, really enjoy doing that. Again, love the sport and love being involved, but also enjoy supporting young people. Not quite like an actual Big Buddy does, but yeah, showing up for and being there for young people.
Yeah, and that's being a Big Buddy, really, isn't it? I mean, I looked at the Big Buddy program myself a few years ago, and then shortly after became a dad. And so my time for the last 6 or 7 years now has been running after my own two kids, but I also coach my daughter's football team. And just to know that you're there for these young girls or these young boys is so rewarding. And we know that about volunteer work. It makes ourselves feel great, as well as knowing that we're helping others. It's just a panacea for any sort of dark clouds that you may have on that particular day. Can I just ask, though, do many of the young buddies come through, you know, the system, or come through and say, you know what, I'm so grateful for this program, I want to give back and I want to be a Big Buddy?
Not yet. That's coming. We're getting close to that. We've got a couple of guys, little buddies, who have communicated their interest, but haven't quite started the process, and we haven't yet matched an older little buddy with a younger little buddy.
That'll be a well moment for you, won't it?
Sure.
Hey? Yeah, well done. Hey, look, thanks, Paul. Thanks for joining the program and for telling us about your program. You're doing some great work, and it's nice to hear stories of young men, middle-aged men, who are giving back in the best possible way, and the benefits for both them and the little guy is just so, so profound. So it's really awesome. Thank you.
singing.
Zoot Suit Riot by the Cherry Popping Daddies on Take It From Us. Nourished for Nil was established as a not-for-profit food rescue organisation. They've become a food bank, helping many people in the Hawke's Bay since the devastating cyclone swept through 1 month ago. Christina Macbeth is the founder of Nourished for Nil and joins us on the program. Thanks for your time on Take It From Us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
How are things in the Bay?
Well, you know, we've just officially entered the recovery stage of the cyclone. It's been, I think the biggest thing for everybody down with here was the fact that we were not expecting to actually have this cyclone hit us the way it did. In fact, it was really much worse than I think most people had even sort of given themselves to imagine it would be. There's a lot of shell-shocked people walking around just trying to make sense. Those who've lost, you know, not only maybe their gardens or a vehicle, but they've lost their entire home. Some people even had their homes swept off the foundations down the valley. I mean, absolutely mind-blowing, the level of devastation. I know when you watch people who've suffered cyclone damage overseas, it's, you know, downed trees or power lines or maybe a ripped roof or something. But down here it was like, you know, like some people were wiped off the map. And crazy.
Is there still the sense of shock? Have you moved past that?
Look, from what we get a range of people coming in, some who feel like they're slowly coming to terms with what's happened. And then we have some who are just, you know, they're still running on disbelief and adrenaline because they are helping so many people around them, but they themselves are also deeply affected. And I mean, I had a woman here just the other day say, you know, I haven't even sat down yet because I know when I do, I'm not going to stop crying. So I think there's a fair bit of that, you know, people just right now in that mode where you have to just put one foot in front of the other. And, one day they're just going to have to stop and reconcile with what's happened. So there's a fair bit of that too. But, you know, fortunately, Kent, we're lucky down here. There's also a huge area that wasn't too deeply affected. So those people can help those who were.
I guess you're seeing some tremendous community spirit in action where it's so needed, eh?
Yeah, you know, that's probably been the most, and the biggest silver lining in all of this is just people really going out of their way to do whatever they can. You know, I was reading the other day, someone said, even if you can't go out and shovel silt, you can buy a shovel for someone else to do it, or you can cook a meal to support the person who's doing that work. You know, there's something for everyone. And I think it's really important that people have the opportunity to, you know, to offer something, some form of help, because it makes them feel better about the situation, that they've done something, no matter how small. And some of us are doing way more than others, but, you know, no one's counting. Everyone's just putting their hand in together, and many hands make better work.
And your organization, Nourished for Nil, how are you helping? What's your role?
Right, so Nourish for Nil is primarily we're a food rescue organization. We started 6 years ago, and we've created a huge network down here of donors, suppliers, recipients. And we are also a food bank, and we're also a social supermarket, and we can turn ourselves into a crisis center on a dime, which is what we did with the cyclone. And so we can respond truly in whatever manner is needed. We can support the community on a day-to-day basis with the food that we rescue and that we are donated. And then we can also purchase food to make food parcels, flood relief parcels that are adequate to support a family for, you know, 4 or 5 days. And we can include fresh produce in that. We can include frozen and chilled. Pretty much anything on a food level we can help supply, and on short notice, because we've been doing this for quite some time.
Yeah, you guys, you're good at what you do. How about the supply of food, being able to access, I guess, food that you would have had that's been greatly affected or even washed away by the cyclone?
You know, that first week was a bit of a challenge because a lot, you know, the supply chain was completely disrupted and there was panic. Fortunately, we sort of were foreseeing, you know, they were talking about this cyclone for a few weeks beforehand. And in the back of my mind, I thought, well, you know what, I think we're just going to stockpile some stuff, you know, on the offhand that we do need it. It's better to not need it and have it than the other way around. So we were able, we have got quite a big warehouse here. It's about 400 square. And it's, you know, we were able to start to put enough aside. So when the cyclone hit and we had those sort of 2-3 days where the supply was not happening, we could buffer that. And then once the, you know, crisis management went into full-blown mode, there was suddenly a lot of food that was coming up from, you know, the Palmerston North direction. A lot of the supermarkets here, they also have a bit of a, I don't know, I wouldn't use the word stockpile, but they had enough stock that they were sharing it. And we were, you know, the wheels started turning pretty fast and everybody sort of pitched in to make food available on an emergency.
And what's the greatest, as far as the food supply goes now, 3 or 4 weeks on, what's the greatest need that you're noticing?
Getting the food out to, there are still pockets of people that are cut off. Now they've been contacted and there have been people who've, you know, found them. But there's still lots of bridges and roads that are completely impassable. So it's taking, you know, a labor of love of a community who, you know, four-wheel drivers, I think, I don't know if they're still helicoptering food, and I don't think so. But, you know, civil defense and the army and rapid response teams were still going into the hills and, you know, trying to drop the food into areas where it can then be sent out to, you know, the different people can come to, like, a depot. Like, they've been doing it in schools. Marais have been acting as depots. Fire stations have been rural fire stations. So that's the biggest challenge, is still getting that food to individuals. And the parcels we make are available to the public to come and get if they need, and also members of the public come and get the parcels, load them in their vehicles, and then do their own drives through the, you know, as far as they can get. Yeah, that's the biggest challenge, logistics.
How can we help?
I think, I think there's a lot of food here, but the struggle for some, you know, for longevity for a lot of areas is probably finances, because you're not talking about a problem that's going to get solved or get sorted out in the next couple of weeks or a couple of months. You know, this is massive. This is potentially years before, you know, Hawke's Bay gets back on its feet properly. And, donations on a financial, you know, whether it's a give a little page or somebody's doing a fundraiser or somebody wants to donate directly into an account, you know, anywhere, if you've seen a shop, that little thing that says, you know, Cyclone Gabriel donation box, you know, throw in a gold coin. Those sort of things really, you know, they're going down to the right places and they're reaching the right organizations and people that are really going to need that in the long term.
Is there anything to be optimistic and hopeful about?
Definitely. There's definitely signs of, a couple of stories of families who have now moved in together because, one family lost their home. And they realize that actually living together is pretty special, because not only is it cheaper, but they have a common cause to be in the same space. And, you know, they find that their children actually get on really well. And, you know, it's that co-living. I think a fair bit of that happened after the pandemic. And something like a cyclone has also helped, instigate a little bit more of that. And I think for some people, you know, they're so loyal and they love the Hawke's Bay that, you know, they're just, they seeing this as a challenge and an opportunity to practice resilience and really make the absolute most of a devastation and turn it into something positive. And I know the community's been, you know, really touched by not only, you know, organizations like ourselves, but even, you know, Waddies and manufacturers are starting to put, you know, a bit more effort into their into endeavors, maybe climate change endeavors, or ways that they can support future, you know, events to make this a more resilient place, to equip people better. So I think there's going to be a lot of silver linings, a lot of good things that come out of that. And it does, eh? I mean, devastation anywhere always has fruit. And it'll take time maybe to see it on a mass scale, but there's definitely little signs.
Well, it's really nice to hear, and thanks for sharing that. And thanks for all the work that you're doing, Christina. And go well. We wish you all the very best.
Thank you so much, Ken.
And check out Christina's website, nourished4nil.org. We thank Christine Macbeth for joining us on Take It From Us today. Our other guests on the program, Paul Burns from Big Buddy, and also a very special thanks to Amanda for sharing us her story about problem gambling and the trouble that she's found in her life, but the fact now that she's doing well thanks to some great assistance. So it was lovely to have everyone on our program today. Thanks also to Karen Murphy for producing. Thanks for your input. We do value it. Remember to leave us a note via our Facebook page, Take It From Us. Can you please like the page if you get to it? And also our brand new website, takeitfromusradio.org. That is TIFU radio.org. Leave us a note. Tell us how you're doing. If there are people that you think should be joining us on the program, let us know. That's how we roll. Have a great week. We'll talk to you again very, very soon. Take care.
You've been listening to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns, produced by Karen Murphy, executive producer Andrew Dewhurst, made with the real stories and voices from our community. And for that, we thank you. For more information on anything you've heard on today's show, or for direction on where to seek further advice or assistance, visit our Facebook page, Take It From Us.